everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Fundamentally Sound Podcast, episode 31 now. And as always, your guys, Reeks from Barstool Sports and Ben Bross. Ben, what's going on, man?
Not too much, man. We've been talking about a little bit, but we are inching closer day by day, by day, by day, by day. And I talked about this with you. You don't even know what movie that's from.
No, what's that from?
Day by Day, We Pray, Day by Day. Meet the Parents.
Oh, dude, I haven't seen that movie in so long.
At the dinner table, like that. The dinner table scenes. Yeah.
The dinner
epic
scenes are great.
When the urn falls and the cat pisses on me.
No, I haven't seen that movie in forever. I gotta go back and rewatch that.
Episode 31. I didn't even look at who you had. Who do you have for this?
Jason Terry.
Jason Terry, that's a good one. Yeah. I got a really good one for you.
Who? It's Reg.
You know, yeah, it's Reg.
This is the fuck Reggie Miller episode.
This is the Reggie Miller.
This is the fuck
the Reggie
Miller episode.
Reggie Miller's looking good episode.
This is the Reggie Miller's the worst player in the Hall of Fame episode.
Hater, 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 hater. There's some good 31s. 31's not a bad number.
31's a shitty number because it's Reggie Miller.
What about the Ron Baker episode? Your New York Nick, Ron Baker.
Whatever. I mean,
Angel Delgado.
Delgado, yeah, Delgado's a good one. I've been
you're on Delgado's, the Stephen Hall train.
Yeah, well, I've been a Delgado stan for a couple years now too. Like I was preaching pretty hard about him last year. I was hard and early on his numbers for Swanigan's numbers. Going, if you want to talk about Swanigan being a double-double machine and everything like that, you need to also be saying the same stuff about Delgado.
Yeah, he's going to get that type hype out the gate.
I mean,
he's just going to
15 and 13 last year.
And I think he's going to put up 18 and 14. I mean, it's hard to go past 13.
I mean, I think you'll see him like – I don't know if he'll put up 18 just because – Seton Hall's so balanced offensively.
They have some depth. Yeah.
I think like, you know, like 16 and a half, 14 and a half type numbers is going to be realistic.
I wonder, like, he's probably got to be getting close like this year to setting the all-time rebound record.
Yeah, I gotta go look, see how close he is and if it's a realistic possibility too. Just because there's some dudes like at mid majors too who just get like, you know, 19 boards a game. Not saying that that's nothing to shake your head at, but there's guys that are just so much better than the competition at the mid major level that just go out and just absolutely stuff the
just stat stuff. Yeah. And almost like they're so much bigger than everyone that when they miss, they get every offensive rebound put back.
Not only that, they're just more athletic.
A little bit of a mixture of both, I'd
like
to think.
Because it's like, you know, sometimes you're like that 6'8", you know, wing or four guy and you're just super athletic where you can just crash the glass and you know, you see it all the time at that level. But so this episode we're going to spend a little bit of time just me and you talking about the Joel Berry situation and just injuries as a whole, kind of some Midnight Madness talk. And then we have good friend of the program, Chad Brendel, who is the owner of BearcatJournal.com here in Cincinnati. I've done a TV show with him, done a couple podcasts with him. He obviously covers Cincinnati, if you can't figure it out, by Bearcat Journal. To talk some AAC, he's obviously knows that conference quite well, and Cincinnati being one of the two main programs in that conference this year. Have him on to talk about the conference and, you know, go along with our previews. It's a Cincinnati week though. We have Chad on today, and then Friday's the live show with Rick Browering, who's here in Cincinnati as well, who covers Xavier, down at Queen City Exchange, where we'll be doing our Big East preview with Rick. So a lot going on, but let's get into kind of the major news this week. Joel Berry breaking, officially fracturing his hand?
Fractured, yeah. Which is a break.
Yeah, so he's out.
It's virtually the same thing.
Out 4 to 6 weeks. I talked about this in my ACC preview yesterday. We're recording this on Tuesday. I did my ACC preview on Monday. This is not – there's two ways to look at this for Carolina. One, it's a blessing in disguise because you get younger guys like Felton and Seventh Woods to now have to come in, get some experience at the point guard level, at the point guard position at the collegiate level. Seventh Woods obviously did play last year, but Felton's a freshman. And not only that, but they're winnable games, and they're playing decent teams. Like, if you look at their schedule, like, there's Michigan, there's Bucknell, who's a really, really good mid-major. So on one hand, you can sit there and look at it that way. On the other hand, the way I look at it is two keys to Roy Williams' teams: having bigs that can crash the boards, especially on the offensive side, and get free points with offensive rebounds and putbacks.
They don't and have a point guard who can run the floor and do the secondary break.
Right. That's
you said
the key to Roy
all along. And I knew you were going to be on the side of the fence of option B, and I'm totally option A.
Well, I would. Here's why I'm option B, though. It's because they don't have either one. Like, they needed one of the two. Like, if they had bigs, I would be more on option A. But the fact that they're changing the style of play is where I'm more on option B.
I just think they have enough talent early on. Like you said, that schedule is challenging, but not like overly crazy.
Right.
Where, like, I think this is a blessing in disguise, where you throw guys into the mix, they get PT, they can make mistakes. They don't, as long as they don't bomb, which they won't bomb and go 0-10 or 0-12 by the time Joel Berry gets back. I mean, I'm over exaggerating for the sake of argument. This will be a good thing for them. I really do, because Joel Berry's going to come back. And whatever they do, they're going to get better with him. And so there's a chance to get them better without him right now.
Yeah, like, you know, again, the reason I'm on the other side is they're switching to this now small ball style that they have to play just because there's a lack of depth at the front court and size. They're still going to have to take time to gel once Berry comes back. It's not like they've played in the system with him before. Now that kind of trickles into conference play. You know, you hope he's healthy for like Christmas break, where they can get some extra practices in. You know, I just think of that maybe it would have happened a little bit earlier, to where they're practicing without him, or vice versa, or later where they have some sort of more practices with him in this new system. I don't know. Just in this specific scenario, like, I usually lean on your side of, hey, the early season, you're not going to lose your season in the early portion of the year, but I really want, if you're switching styles and everything like that, you need that experience out there.
I'm not buying the whole like switching styles thing yet, until I watch them like in games play. Like,
I mean, they just don't have bigs though.
I get it. But like at the end of the day, dude, these coaches stick to their guns and even teach the kids, even if they're undersized, they're going to teach what they know and what's been successful for them. And they're just going to have to like dig deep, and they're going to struggle a little bit doing it, but they'll be better later on because they're struggling doing it the way that he's always done it.
Maybe, but I mean, there's no secret to them offensive rebounding. It's just having big dudes like Kennedy Meeks and Tony Bradley and Sean May.
I mean, you say that, but like there's a rhyme and a reason to it. Like, obviously, offensive rebounds a little more cut and dry, right? Like, go get the ball. When the shot goes up, make a move.
Right.
But, like, when you're drilling it in their heads, which I'm sure they will be, it's going to take time for them to learn, like, every second. Some of those guys probably aren't programmed to do that, so it's going to be a struggle for them to be like, oh, I got to go to the glass every time.
But here's also the other thing is the way the offense is run is these guys are traditionally in position already down in the paint. Like, Kennedy Meeks wasn't really drifting up to the – too far into the high post and out to the three-point line. Luke May is a guy that's going to drift out to the three-point line. They're going to run the high pick and pop with him and get, you know, let Berry attack off the dribble and things like that, and kind of beat you, you know, space and pace type play. They weren't doing that with like Kennedy Meeks and, you know, Isaiah Hicks and Tony Bradley. It was, they're already kind of more in position. That's where I think, you know, it's a weird team too with UNC this year, just because it's so drastic of what we've seen in the past with them. That's the only reason I differentiate in this of give me Berry for the entire year. So, you know, I hate trying to come up. All right. Well, sorry about that. I just completely lost internet there in the middle of ranting about why, you know, the systems and everything like that. Technology sucks. Internet sucks. Everything's a monopoly, and
technology doesn't suck, because we didn't have technology, we couldn't do this.
Yeah, that's true. No, we could. We just like handwrite it and like photocopy or like.
Technology sucks when it sucks.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Well, what sucks out here in Cincinnati too, there's just a monopoly. Like, there's two places to go get internet, and they both suck.
And which ones are they?
Time Warner and Cincinnati Bell. I have Time Warner. I've had Cincinnati Bell before, and that sucked. Time Warner.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I don't know if our house just in a – like, because I never had any problems at our old place. And this new one, I don't know if maybe we're just – we're closer to the city, which makes zero sense. So I don't know if maybe we're in like a little dead spot or what, but
– not good for the basement blogger.
No. Like, if you can help with internet, shout me out, because slide into the DMs and I will – like give you a shirt.
They're open for a reason.
Yeah, seriously. And it's my DMs are open. I get some weird DMs. But it's usually people like complaining about something or trying to tell me like what like some obvious college basketball statement as if I've never watched a game.
Are you gonna give a PSA about your favorite statement that I saw you tweeted today?
Oh, about how I hate every team and I love your just remember with the season starting, whether you're reading my stuff online, reading Twitter, listening to the podcast, I hate your team and I love your rival. And that's every single person.
That's a good way to live.
I've just started embracing
it. It answers every question before they ask you.
Yeah. Like, why do you hate my team? Well, I hate every team.
And your rival? They're great.
Love them.
They're Final Four bound.
Right. And they're favorites to win it. Every year too. Like, I don't care who you are. Like, I love your rival.
Let's get back to it though.
Back to Joel Berry. More importantly, back to injuries. Man, this year, I don't know if it's
a lot of preseason. I don't know. Maybe I'm paying attention more, but yeah. A lot of preseason injuries.
And significant.
Of significance,
ones too.
Like, yeah.
You Joel Berry, I would say like UNC is not a top 10 team, but they're still a top 15, top 20 team. Joel Berry is obviously injured. And then you look at who else is out there. Off the top of my head, here's how I was able to think of. Jared Vanderbilt at Kentucky. John Igbunu at Florida. Landry Shamet, Marcus McDuffie at Wichita State. Raleigh Hawkins at Arizona. All injured and all expected to miss time.
None of those have been announced season ending, though.
No. Like, they're all expected to come back. But
yeah, I mean, but that's huge.
Either way, right. Like, that's bad for college basketball.
No, it's definitely bad, and bad for Wichita State, because that team with those two, like, especially Shamet, like, they are a potential Final Four team.
Well, yeah, I mean, Raleigh Hawkins at Arizona, there's another – I mean, all these teams are potential Final Four teams. Kentucky, potential Final Four. Florida, potential Final Four. Wichita State, Arizona. And I'm trying to think, like, these are the ones that came to my head. I'm sure I'm missing one or two other ones.
I think we are. I should have done a little more research on this today just to make sure we had a whole list. Like, we need like an injury report for really sound.
But I mean, even if we are, we're only missing one or two other key ones that just aren't popping off at the top of my head. But I don't remember a season. I mean, were you on a team? I was trying to remember. Was it your senior year where you guys had the injury point guard?
Yeah, my junior year, Josh Gosser stepped on my foot and tore his ACL.
What wasn't there something senior year though with the point guard situation?
Oh, the next year Trey Jackson against Rutgers broke his ankle, and then Koenig stepped into the starting role.
That's right, and then he came back.
Then he came back against North Carolina.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah,
okay.
His first game was North Carolina in that Sweet 16.
That's what I thought. I mean, what's it like for a team? And you've never been on none of your Wisconsin's team had a major injury heading into the year, right? It was all in-season injuries?
No, Josh was like right now, like exhibition season.
Was it? Okay.
We were practicing before we played DePaul for like our close scrimmage, and I was getting back on defense, and he stepped on my foot and tore his ACL. And, I mean, that was a guy who was expected to play 36 minutes a game, be the leading point guard, and – this is really relatable to what's happening for a couple of these teams, minus the fact that a lot of them are going to be coming back, is it opens up opportunity. I mean, I had a decent sophomore year, scored 7-8 points a game, but I had no choice my junior year but to step up and, make something happen.
Right.
And I mean, Josh is my best friend. I never wanted that to happen. But I had to step up. Like, I had no choice but to play 36 minutes a game and score double digits, average double digits. But who knows if Josh plays, like, the guys like Trey Jackson and George Marshall and Sam Decker was coming off the bench that year. Well, where were my minutes? Was it going to be 36 or was it going to be more like 20?
Right.
So it really changes the landscape of opportunity. That's why I look at the UNC scenario as a, you know, this is a no lose situation, other than if you really bomb,
or if Barry never comes back completely healthy.
If he's not the same player that he was the last couple of years.
That, or you just lose confidence. You know, there's a lot of mental things that can happen because, again, you're talking 18 to 22-year-old kids. You know, maybe they get off to a slower start. Maybe Cam Johnson doesn't fully buy, you know, get into – no, I should say buy into the system. Fully doesn't get integrated into the system right away as a transfer. You know, maybe whatever happens. Again, you're talking kids, and anything can happen when you're talking 18 to 22-year-old kids.
Hopefully I didn't jinx him by picking him my MVP of the ACC in our preview.
Yeah. But from a coaching standpoint, what did the coaches say, if anything, when Gosser goes down to the team? Were a team loses a starter and now it's okay, we're getting ready for games in a week and a half, 2 weeks?
The message is really, and it's always been like that at our program.
Is it cliche?
It's cliche. Yeah. It's next man up, you know, next soldier, you know, that type mentality where you're just gonna plop the next guy in and you don't wait.
Sounds good. So I want to touch on that. We're going to bring Chad on now. After the interview with Chad, we'll do a little recap. I want to touch on Midnight Madnesses with you. So we'll touch on that after the interview with Chad. But again, this is Chad Brendel, who's the owner of BearcatJournal.com here in Cincinnati for our AAC preview. All right, and as mentioned, our interview now with Chad Brendel, the owner of BearcatJournal.com. Chad, what's going on, man?
Not much, man. Just finished up a podcast of my own and hopping on with you guys. A full night of talking college basketball. It's just how I'd like it.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than the last time me and you did that, where it was the FBI investigation.
Chaos. Day. Yeah, total chaos.
We at least know a little bit what we're talking about now and just not guessing about what the FBI does and doesn't know. But
are you guys surprised? Hang on real quick. Are you surprised that it is, like, I feel like as quick as it hit us is as quick as it's kind of been silent right now?
Not really, because like what I do get a kick out is people that act like they have like an in at the FBI. Like, like I hear that this is happening, or I hear that that school is. No, you didn't. Nobody had any clue what in the hell
before this came out. You're
was
right.
going on
right.
before it came out, and we're not going to have any clue when the next wave hits.
I don't know. My Twitter DMs with like the dudes with like 14 followers.
Yeah.
We're very in tune to the FBI investigation and had sources.
Well, my uncle just finished a FBI training class at Quantico, so I think I'm qualified now that like I've gotten in at the FBI. So yeah, anything you guys need to know, just ask me and right, I'll have the info quickly.
Oh, so let's get right into it. Obviously, the American's a unique conference because it's clearly not a mid-major, but it's not perceived at the national level as a Major Six is what I call the college basketball conferences. Obviously, you have the Power Five plus the Big East in basketball. Big East has solidified itself to me as a Major Six conference.
The Mid-Major Plus conference?
What was that?
Are we going to call it a Mid-Major Plus conference?
Well, it's kind of in purgatory. So my question to Chad, because I have an idea of what needs to happen, but I want to know what Chad thinks of what does the conference have to do to be considered a, you know, major seven conference now, or to get closer to that major six?
First off, they need to win some big out of conference games.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the main thing. Like the way that this conference has performed over the past couple years, they're out of the conversation by early December. I mean, you can't just have like last year it was Cincinnati and SMU and that was it.
Right.
You know, there wasn't anybody else that did anything in the out of conference to differentiate themselves and say, this is a team that could potentially make the NCAA tournament. This is a team that you have to keep on your radar. There was none of that. It was Cincinnati and SMU. And until UConn gets back to normal, I think we're a long way away from Memphis figuring out what the hell is going on there. But, you know, adding Wichita State certainly helps, but the likes of Temple and the likes of Houston and SMU and you can add UCF this year. The problem is the conference hasn't really had a middle that matters.
Yeah.
There's been a really good top and a really terrible bottom and a middle that's irrelevant. And that's not how you get into that upper echelon. The way you get into that upper echelon is you have six or seven teams that on any given night can beat the top team. And this conference hasn't achieved that yet.
Yeah, because I thought heading before the Wichita State announcement, it was this conference needs UConn to be UConn. You know, they're supposed to be the flag bearer of this conference. They're supposed to be, you know, the team that was the high seed every year and winning conference titles. Cincinnati, who I thought was always, you know, supposed to be the firm number two. But then Memphis was always supposed to be that third team. They're supposed to rely on those three. Now when you have Wichita, I feel like that at least takes off some of the burden on Memphis. But you need Wichita, Cincinnati, and UConn to be those, you know, top 25 to top 30 teams in the year after year.
Yeah.
And then one or two other teams that are, you know, fringe top 25 teams throughout the year. And that can rotate, whether it's Temple, whether it's UCF for a year, whether it's you know, a Tulsa gets hot for yeah. a year or something like that. But, you know, I agree with you completely, and I would want to get your take on it because it's just a weird conference, man, because it's so hard to judge. Like you said, when you look at, you know, last year Cincinnati SMU are those two teams that are top 25 teams, and then it's just – and then what? Like you had sub 200 teams at the bottom of the conference, and that's not good for a conference that's trying to be – perceived as, you know, the other six major ones.
Well, think of it like this. Last year, Cincinnati played six what are called A games on KenPom.
Right.
Six. That's it. And that they played Iowa State and Butler and Xavier out of conference. And they only had six. And you got to figure three of those were
the SMU. Right.
So there were no other – they didn't have a single other opportunity in the conference to get an A game. That can't happen if you want to be considered a power conference.
No. And do you know off the top of your head how many B games they had? Was it
– six.
For B2?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's – six. You got to have – I mean, you got to have a total of like 18 A and B games.
And that's why they got docked the seed line, and that's why they ended up playing UCLA in the second round. The only time in NCAA tournament history that two 30-win teams played in the second round was because of Cincinnati's schedule and because the conference was terrible last year.
And you have to imagine that this is going to get tougher for them as you hear the Big Ten's expanding into 20 games, and the ACC, obviously, with the amount of teams that they have. The Power Six conferences right now, they're – adding games to their schedule, which I think gives the conference more chance for teams to have better wins on their resume, which enhance their chances to get into the NCAA tournament, which in essence hurts an ACC. Do you think that's fair?
I think
AAC, sorry.
It's 100% what the Power Six is trying to do. They're trying to squeeze out and not necessarily the AAC level, because I still think out of conference, those games are going to bring you some value,
right.
But they're trying to squeeze out all of the other mid majors. They're trying to make, you know, 20 conferences, one bid leagues, because they're not going to get that opportunity to play, you know, a North Carolina or a Kentucky or whatever the case may be to show that, you know, maybe they don't win that game, but maybe it's on their resume as like an 8-point loss. And the committee has to look at it and say, you know what, they went into Rupp Arena and they lost by eight. You know, that team's pretty legit. There's not going to be those opportunities, because you have to figure, you know, teams are still going to want their five or six bye games.
I mean, they have to.
Yeah, because coaches
will still hire their buddy or still play their buddies that were the assistant coaches that are now coaching at, you know, Morehead State or Northern Kentucky or whatever it might be.
Well, and an athletic department has to hit its budget.
Yeah, that's the other thing, yeah.
You know, so you need those five or six bye games to put 10,000 people in the stands and give you an extra, you know, couple million dollars into your athletic budget. Like those aren't going anywhere. So you have, you know, you take 20 conference games, you do the 4-game exempt tournament, that's 24. You have a conference challenge, that's 25. And then you have 5 bye games. Now you've got one extra game.
Yeah. And that's
for 31.
And the only ones that are getting that are the A-10 and the AAC when you talk outside right. of the major six.
I mean, this speaks to the Illinois State coach's point of like, hey, look, I'm trying to – like, does anyone want to schedule me? Like, will you schedule me? And there's just not enough slots now at this rate with all the tournaments they play in from Thanksgiving to some Christmas events to the challenges that go on between conferences. I don't know. Is there a solution to – giving more opportunities to the mid-major teams that are looking to play more A games?
No, because the Power Six doesn't want those teams to have that.
Yeah. Hope they get into the exempt tournament.
Yeah. I mean, that's becoming the only shot that those programs are going to have to get
go
to swing
undefeated.
At the big boys. Yeah. Go undefeated or get in an exempt tournament and take one swing on a neutral court at one of the big boys.
Hope you get to like the Maui title game or finish third in Maui or something like
that. Yeah. And they're not getting to Maui. You got to hope for like the Paradise Jam.
Right. That's like, where you get, I mean, like Villanova in the title game in Charleston or something like that.
Well, like the tournament that Cincinnati's in this year is a perfect example in the Cayman Islands. The Cincinnati's on one side, Iowa's on the other, and then like UAB and Buffalo and Richmond and a couple of those teams are scattered in there that are pretty solid mid-majors. Their only chance going forward is going to be in that type of tournament and in the first or second round of that event. Knock off a Cincinnati or Iowa on one side of that bracket.
And then hope you get the other in the title game.
Yeah.
So you get at least two games.
This is maybe a question that I don't know if there's an answer. Who chooses the schedule for these Thanksgiving tournaments? Is it just like a random committee, like for the Cancun tournament or like, you know what I mean? Like, because if anything, this would be a good opportunity for the coaches to be like, hey, we're going to this tournament. We want to play them. How does that work?
There's a couple power brokers in the game that decide who's in those tournaments. There's three or four guys that pretty much that each have a host of tournaments that they represent. And if you're not in with those guys, you don't get in. That's you talk about the seedy underbelly of college basketball. That's just as seedy as anything else is those guys that decide who and how you get into those events. Like I know Cincinnati, in a lot of ways, the guy that runs the Maui event, who is a fairly prominent name in college basketball, I won't past at least, I won't mention him straight up. But Cincinnati, the last time they were in Maui, they replaced Louisville because Louisville backed out, and Cincinnati didn't have the opportunity to sell a lot of those tickets because they were kind of a last minute addition. Well, now they're being punished because they didn't sell that Maui event, so they can't get back into Maui and they can't get into any of the other events that this guy does because his stance is that they don't travel well. If you remember that Maui tournament, they made it to the finals and almost knocked off Gonzaga that year with Yancey Gates. So it's not a very clean system, and if you're not in with the couple guys that set these events up, you have a lot of trouble, and you've got to kind of go out of your way to figure out what events you're going to play in, and you end up at the Cayman Islands with a bunch of mid-majors in Iowa on the other side of the bracket.
Right. So getting back to the AAC and where they are kind of in this no-man's territory, the next best conference is what they are, but what's the biggest misconception about the conference that you've seen covering it for what, the last – is this the fifth year that it's been around? Right.
Yeah, it's year 5.
Yeah,
it's year 5. You know, I used to think there were some misconceptions, but after last year, I don't really have a whole lot to say. It's the seventh best conference. I mean, until the middle steps up, I the thing I worry about, Bobby, is I don't think the bottom is ever going to get better.
No, like what's East Carolina going to do to get better? What's South Florida? Like, you know, they're not going to beat out recruits in that area from Miami or anything like that.
No. So what those teams have to do is get above 200. They're 300 teams.
Right. You want them to eventually have the year where where maybe the year where Tulsa can jump up to the top four in the conference is the year East Carolina's 500.
Right. What's hurting right now, and you know, when you look at the way that, RPI and all that stuff works, the bottom three teams have been sub 300 teams.
Right.
Low, high 200s or 300s. So you're adding five or six bye games
within the conference
to your resume within the conference. That's awful. I mean, that is a killer. And until you find a way to fix that at the bottom, and until you find a way to fix the middle, and get UConn back on track, get Memphis back on track. You know, if you've got a strong Wichita State, Cincinnati, UConn, and Memphis, guess what? You're in pretty good shape. And then you've got behind them SMU and Temple and Houston. Now you've got, you know, a pretty solid seven, and you're doing pretty good, and you're where the Big East is right now. But at this point, they're not even close to that.
No, because, I mean, I happened to write about the Big East today, and the eight teams, like, it's wide open. Outside, you know, Villanova's number one, yeah, kind of a clear top four, but five to eight are all tournament teams that are wide open in the Big East. When you look at the American, it feels like it's Cincinnati and Wichita this year, and then SMU probably third, and then what? And who's good after that, too?
Yeah, I think Temple will be okay with Josh Brown back.
Like, they UConn, should be.
They should be. UConn, I don't know, man. I'm not a big Kevin Ollie guy.
No, I mean, I've had numerous conversations with people all around the country that are well respected, you know, that know basketball, and it's, he's the worst coach to ever win a national title, and it's not close.
I would have to agree.
And credit him for winning. Like, he still won one. People would trade, you know, their left nut for it, but
I could tell you a lot of stories I've heard from that team. Maybe one day we'll get together and do that.
Start telling them.
I just heard the team about three quarters of the way through the season said, we're doing our thing. Like Shabazz said, get on my back and let's go. Like, we're not running sets. We're not worried about, you know, what you're telling us. We're doing what the guys before taught us. We're doing what Kemba showed us how to do in terms of winning. And we're going to go out and take this, you know, we're taking it into our own hands. And that's what they did.
They hope he hit the scouting report in terms of know whether to guard the guy left-handed or right-handed to start the game.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they basically just, it was a mutiny, and they said, we're taking this, you know, we're taking over the locker room. And they got lucky that they got placed in Madison Square Garden for that, the Sweet 16 and Elite Eight. And once I saw that,
and
I said,
injury to Georges Niang.
Yeah, and I said, look, if UConn gets to Madison Square Garden, Shabazz is taking them to the Final Four.
Yeah, I mean, that was.
And everybody told me I was crazy. I was like, the biggest question is, do they win their first two games? If they win their first two,
they should have beat St. Joe's.
No, but if they win their first two, they're winning the next two. And it happened. And then to see them win the national title was one of the craziest things I've ever seen. And think about that, Bobby. Those 2 years, okay, that was the first year of the American. The year before that, Louisville wins the title. They're in the American that year. The first year of the American wins the title, and this conference wasn't able to build on that.
Right, and wasn't that year the year that they had Shabazz, Kilpatrick, and Russ Smith?
And yeah, they had three first-team All-Americans the first year of the conference.
And then since then, it's been
awful.
Like, who's been the best player in the conference since then?
Holy cow.
Like, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. Like, there's no name that just jumps out.
None.
Is it Semi?
Probably.
Like, it might be Ojale, right? Which, he's a good player, but are you – if you're an American – if you're a fan of a team in the American, does that make you feel warm and fuzzy?
Man, that I've never heard it put that way before. Wow.
Right? Yeah, like, no name jumps out.
None.
Yeah, Riggs, and like what we always deal with and people always talk to us about is, you know, how you should be judged based off how you do in the national or in the NCAA tournament. And that's two national championships from those two teams. And there's no argument you could ever make that this conference is better than any of the Power Six conferences, but they have the national championship.
They do, but I mean, now you kind of also have to take that out of it because. I mean, yeah, UConn's still there, but what is
– They're not UConn.
They're not UConn, which – what do they have to do to be relevant again? Like, they're recruiting well. They're still recruiting well. And you can chalk up last year to the – you know, all the injuries they had. But what do they have to do to be relevant again?
Well, I think you talked about it just a second ago. Ali's got to go.
Well,
yeah.
But I agree with that. But then are you bringing in, like, what kind of coach? Obviously not like a former UConn player.
I've been saying it so many times. The two most interesting things in college basketball.
Danny Hurley.
Yeah, probably will be Danny Hurley. But the two most interesting things to me will be the coaching searches at Syracuse and UConn once Ali and Boeheim are out of there, because we've never seen a coaching search happen at those two schools. And
yeah.
Kind of the same thing that happened at Georgetown, though. I mean, do you expect anything to go out of the system and how it's run?
I mean, that's a little bit different because John Thompson's still alive and still has influence, and they just
Jim Boeheim will still be alive.
They're practicing in the John Thompson Center,
which was just built.
Yeah,
it's not like it's been around for 20 years. Like Boeheim has credit, but like if they would just hired Hopkins, that would have been one thing. Hopkins isn't going to come back to Syracuse.
Look, I'm just playing devil's advocate for a second here, just trying to see if you think that these schools would do anything outside the realm of what UConn and UConn fans know.
UConn will have to, because we've seen the Ollies. We've seen what happened.
Well, there's nobody else in that pipeline that they could hire.
Donyell Marshall would be the only other one, really.
Yeah. I think Danny Hurley would be a home run there.
That would make the most sense if you're not going Donyell Marshall, which they shouldn't. I mean, I think Marshall is going to be a decent coach, but if you're not going there, I think you have to go Danny Hurley, call number one. And I'm not even a huge Danny Hurley fan. I think he's a great recruiter. I question a lot what he does in game and scheme wise, but
yeah, I don't doubt that. But he's put together a heck of a roster for Rhode Island.
He sure has. He's recruiting really well. They're set up. Rhode Island set up well for the future too with this recruiting class. The last, you know, what's going on right now with them up
there.
But yeah, I agree. I think in order for UConn to be relevant again, they have to get Ali out of there. And you can talk about the injury train, but they haven't been injured every year since the national title.
Well, answer me this. Amita Brima was there for what, like 7 years?
I mean, he probably there less than Rodney Purvis was.
Okay, that's fair. And Rodney Purvis is another example. Did either of those guys ever get better?
Zero player development.
I mean,
Amita was the same player every year.
Yeah. Amita Brima was the exact same player from the time he got to campus. He should have been a first-team All-American if you watched him as a freshman and projected him as a senior. He did not get one lick better in his 4 years at UConn.
Well, what about Jalen Adams? Like, Jalen Adams was really good as a freshman, and he's still really good, but he never turned into this.
Hey, Bobby, go back and look at Jalen Adams as a freshman. He was really good against Cincinnati, and that was it.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Maybe that's what I'm just thinking of.
He had three good games against Cincinnati. The rest of his freshman season was trash.
That's true. Those games do just stick out.
Yeah, but he was awesome in those games, and it's against a great defense. Congratulations to you. But his freshman season outside of that was not good. And then last year he only averaged, 14 points on a team that had no players?
Yeah.
And he shot, 40% from the floor. He wasn't efficient at all either.
But he's a player that should be
great.
Easily the preseason American Player of the Year probably this year if developed correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's not.
No.
He's a first team all conference guy, but if you're picking a team in the American Conference, are you taking Jalen Adams over Jacob Evans?
Nope. I'm taking Jacob Evans.
Gary Clark?
I'll take Gary Clark.
Right. I mean, I think PJ Taylor's the best player in this conference. I know that's probably not a popular opinion, and I don't
I still think it's Shamit, but PJ Taylor's really good.
PJ Taylor is a dude.
Yeah,
like,
he's really good.
Shamit, I only worry just because of the injury a little bit.
Yeah. Shamit Stan, though, man. Like, he can score at three levels.
I like him a lot. Yeah. I don't have anything against him. Like, if it would have been Shamit, Taylor or Shake, I would have been fine with the preseason player of the year. I get giving it to Shake because he's, you know, he was in the league last year. I understand it. He probably would have been third on my list behind those other two guys. But what, he's the fourth, fifth? Is he better than Rob Gray?
No, I've had numerous in the conference people, coaches wise, tell me whatever you think of Rob Gray is not high enough.
So he's what, the sixth or seventh best guard in the American Conference?
Yeah, which is crazy.
Like, seriously?
The American probably had, like, they're pretty deep at the guard position.
Yeah.
Like, the guard wing position.
There's no big men. There's Gary Clark, Kyle Washington, and Taco.
Yeah, Taco's and overrated.
Marcus McDuffie.
Again, injured.
Injured. But who else are the big men in this conference?
Shaq Morris, you could count.
Yeah, Devin Davis, I'm a fan of at Houston, the former Indiana forward.
Yeah,
he's solid.
There's not a lot though.
There's almost like Gary Clark and Kyle Washington should dominate.
Yeah.
In this conference, because there's no team that has two guys that can match them.
I'm trying to think of other conferences, and Ben, I don't know if you can think of any during your time where it's been so heavy on either in the backcourt or the frontcourt.
Yeah, no, when I think of the AAC and even just like a lot of mid-major conferences, I don't know if this is bad, but I think it's just the product of you get a lot of the same player. You know, the high major conferences, they end up getting all of the size or all of like – you're just not going to get that talent level in the AAC, and that's no offense to the AAC. You're just going to get a lot of 6'6 wings that crash the glass that are somewhat athletic, and a lot of the guys that you mentioned are like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I think it's a testament too that there's a lot more guards than there are bigs out there.
I mean, everyone
100%. You can't teach size. And that's why even if they stink, they end up going to a bigger program.
Well, and no one wants to be a big anymore. Everyone wants to be a guard or a wing.
And they should, because if you like, it was funny. I was at the Bucks game yesterday watching Kaminsky play, and then we just got talking a little bit about Ethan Happ. And it, like
warming up threes.
He's now a 4-year player. I mean, that's just a sad reality, because I could probably count on my hand how many times the post was touched to like work out of it.
Right.
Like, yeah, you're going to touch the post and like make a quick move, but no one runs the offense through the post. It's all rhythm. It's all dribble, drive, kick. It's all motion. There's just not any of like of a big man presence where like, you're going to run it through them. Can you name a college basketball team that really runs it through their bigs?
Cincinnati.
Cincinnati does.
I mean, yeah, Cincinnati. And one of few teams throughout the country.
I think it depends on team setup.
And that's why their games are 40 to 40 or 50 to 48. They're so low scoring because there's no pace, and they just like they grind it.
They've gotten away from that some now because they actually have good guards to go with. I mean, there's a good balance at Cincinnati. I think that's the thing that really separates Wichita State and Cincinnati in this league. There's a good balance. They have like positions are gone. We all know that, but they're legit. You know, there's three spots. There's a guard, there's a wing, there's a big.
Oh, see, I disagree. I think there's five. It's point, wing, stretch, traditional post, and then LeBron, who just plays all five.
Well, yeah, he doesn't count.
So to me, there's four positions. It's the lead ball.
Yeah.
Off ball.
I won't disagree that the stretch is different than like a post.
Right.
But
right.
You can almost call a stretch a wing at this point.
Close. But Cincinnati and Wichita State have balance across all of those spots.
Well, and that's why they're going to dominate this league.
Yeah, and that's why they're not only threats to dominate this league, but both of them are top 15, you know, top 10 type teams right now.
And can compete outside this league because they can match up with the Power Six conferences that recruit the same way that these top two teams have the potential and ability to play.
Absolutely.
Going back, you know, we talked about coaching with what's going to happen at UConn if they get rid of Ali leaves, whatever. The coaching hires in the American have been unique is the only way I can put it lately. When you look at like Dunleavy at Tulane, Tubby going to Memphis, which made some sense, but
none. Sorry, I don't know.
You don't think so? I mean, I can understand why you wanted out of Texas Tech to go to Memphis.
I can too, but Tubby Smith in Memphis.
No. I meant more of why he would go to Memphis.
No, I get why he left.
Oh yeah.
I can't understand him in Memphis at all.
No. I mean, when you go from passing or like. You want something a little bit different than Passner and Tubby.
So I heard a story when he first took the job. So he gets there. It's like one of his first couple days. And they go in to the practice facility to do a workout. and one of the AAU teams is in there because I guess Memphis just lets some of them use the facility to, and you know, they kind of like you guys got to go. And the AAU team was like, nah, bruh. This is, we're here. Like
this is the world we live in.
When we're done, you guys can have this floor, but until then, have a seat. And that's Memphis, man. That recruiting that city is a wild deal.
Look at like the players who have come out of Memphis, man.
Well, I made this argument.
Memphis, I should say.
I made this argument, and people didn't. I caught some blowback for it. Like if you go watch, and one of the things I do for Bearcat Journal is I'm out on the road a lot in the spring and summer and at the big AAU events. I would argue that there's more Memphis, the city, produces annually more high end talent than Ohio, the state.
I don't necessarily disagree with that because like there hasn't been a ton of high level talent coming from the city of Cincinnati or from the city of Columbus Cleveland. Recently or even
Cleveland either. Yeah.
I mean, Kennard was really the last high major talent, right?
Yeah. And before Kennard, you'd probably have to go back to Sullinger and Kraft.
Yeah.
And like wasn't Diebler Mr. Basketball too there?
Yeah, but that was
I think you're making my argument.
Right.
I really am. That's why I was just throwing that name out there.
Yeah,
but I was trying to think of players, and if that's the player, then you might be winning this.
You go watch Team Penny. They got like three dudes in this class, two dudes in the next class, and then two sophomores that are playing on that team. That you're like, Christ, these kids are all from within like 10 minutes of each other.
Right. Ohio's great at sending guys. Like the state of Ohio is great at sending guys to like the MAC.
Well, and they produce, they feed the Big Ten with rotation guys.
Yep. Yeah, there's a lot of players like that come from the state. None that necessarily are, like you say, the top tier talent.
Yeah. So, I mean, Tubby's just not. Bobby, you are a Kentucky fan. You are aware of the way that Tubby recruits.
It is not Tubby.
Yeah, it is not high level guys that he has to deal with all the crap, and especially not Grandpa Tubby.
Yeah, no, at least when he was there, like he had the number one recruiting class. It didn't pan out when it was the Randolph Morris, Joe Crawford, Ramel Bradley and Rondo class. Like he and that was, I mean, you're talking 13 years ago. Like that was the class of 04. It's different.
They just had a scrimmage where they played really well against somebody, didn't they?
Memphis? I haven't seen anything. They may have.
They did. I can't remember who off the top of my head.
I'd be shy. Like,
well, here's the interesting thing about that Memphis team. Like, that's a Tubby team, right?
Yeah, there's no names on there.
It's a bunch of miscreants and outcasts and junior college castoffs and people nobody have heard of. I wouldn't be shocked if they were okay. But I expect them to be terrible. But that fits the MO of, like, a Tubby team.
They have – I'm looking at just like who they're bringing back. I mean, Jeremiah.
Everybody Martin left. Everybody left.
They have one, two, three, five juniors on their roster, and I think like one recorded stats.
Well, they're all JUCOs, I think.
That's what I'm saying. Like one recorded stats last year. It was Jeremiah Martin.
I mean, everybody. It was the first one out, last one out. Turn off the lights. It was Mick Cronin getting the Cincinnati job.
Yeah.
They added like nine guys. I think
they added a lot. Like,
so,
this is a Tubby team though. This is like the Texas Tech Tubby teams
where they win 22 games and you go, how the hell did he do that?
Yeah.
but he's not going to recruit the big name. Like there's no chance he gets PJ Washington.
No, like he's not going to recruit Memphis the way that you can.
You got to give Penny that job, right?
I would think so, or at least somebody.
No, like he's running
associated where you can put Penny on staff, like as your head assistant.
I mean, at least Penny's like proving it now, right?
Yeah,
he's won two state titles at Memphis East.
That's true. Because you know what, I was very much in the argument of put Brandon Roy in at Washington.
Yeah,
I would feel this. You're right. They should just give it to Penny.
Just give it to Penny.
What do you have to lose? Like. You're in the American. You're not, you know, you're in this conference where you can take this risk if you're Memphis.
And every kid in that city loves Penny.
Oh, that's all they talk about.
Right. He's the man. He's won two state titles. He runs the clear premier AAU team out of the city. He's an icon. He's a basketball legend.
He's still like, young enough where people know
yeah.
him. Kids know him.
I mean, UC was recruiting Alex Lomax a little bit this summer. And I had the chance to talk to Penny. And like 15-year-old me was just like, Oh yeah. Hey Penny, what about that time you lost four times to Cincinnati in 1992?
But do you think they need to do that across like the conference as a whole? Like instead of bringing in guys like Mike Dunleavy, do you
Kelvin
bring in
Sampson?
I mean, yeah, at least Sampson's kind
of he's a good coach.
He's at least turned Houston around a little bit too.
Yeah,
but do you think they need to kind of start kind of targeting the Truman Major coaches, like, you know, try to go get like a John Becker from Vermont or Tim Clues from Iona, one of those type of guys. You know, maybe that's a bad example. Becker's still relatively young. I think Clues is a little older, but someone like that instead of the regurgitated.
Maybe, know, but I think
Brian
that's
Gregory type guy.
I think that's a really tough spot for this league because those guys are just going to be there 3 years and gone.
But yeah, is that good? Is that what they need though? Because at least then you're still getting the three
yeah.
years of that
yeah.
middle being better.
I agree. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you look at the stability that's brought by Kelvin Sampson. I mean, he's brought in some guys that, you know, I know Cincinnati really wanted to bring in Damian Dotson, and the administration said absolutely not. So he's doing some of that where he's touching some guys that the Power Five and some of the power programs aren't going to touch. And that's one way to do it. It would be interesting to see a younger guy in at Houston. Because, again, Houston's an area with a ton of talent.
You don't have to leave a 50-mile radius to recruit.
And also a very tricky AAU scene.
Yeah, but there's a ton of them, though.
Yeah, I mean, you've got Houston Hoops and Houston Defenders and some of the other Texas teams that pull some talent out of Houston. That's as talent rich an area as you can find. Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting proposition. I kind of understand where the athletic directors are at because you're taking a gamble if you bring in one of those young guys.
Right.
Over, you know, a little bit more of a known commodity. But this league is kind of in a position where it's got to take some gambles, I think.
Ben, I want to ask you about that. When you were being recruited by the mid-majors, did you focus on whether the coach was younger or more established or a bigger name or anything like that?
That's a good question. So obviously I've talked about Brad Stevens a lot on this show. I had worried with a guy like Brad Stevens that he was going to leave if I would have went there.
Right.
And so the bet was like, if I would have went there, would Brad Stevens have left in the 4 years that I would have been there? And by the time I went into my senior year, he was gone. So in that scenario, it was a little different. Trying to think of what other mid-majors I really considered. Northern Iowa, I mean, that was just like a solid program. Ben Jacobson's always done a good job. But I'm trying to think because that was like my junior year is really when all the mid-majors were around. And then luckily I was good enough to make the jump from going to mid-major to looking at the high I majors.
Yeah, but even like Jacobson, I mean, he's always rumored to be one of these
yeah,
guys.
Exactly. Like it's something where, like, in my opinion, if you're going to be recruited by a mid-major school, and it's a hot topic mid-major school that's a successful one where the coaches are always going to be thrown around and like rumors, you have to go to the school for more than just basketball.
Yeah, that makes sense, but
is it on the beach? How do the girls look?
Yeah,
no, you literally have to like hit the home run and all the other aspects that are important. Because if Ben Jacobson leaves and then you hate the coach and you're a senior, I mean, obviously you always have the option to transfer and sit out. But if you love the school enough and at that point, like you said, if I was going to pick a mid-major, then I might as well have gone to Long Beach State or somewhere out where I'm going to enjoy the weather.
Go to Florida Atlantic.
Florida Gulf Coast.
Yeah, Florida Gulf Coast.
I would have fit really well at Dunk City.
Yeah, because yeah, you're such an excellent passer and dunker.
Yeah, those are my two specialties.
But sticking with coaches, and I think it's worth talking about just because of how important coaching is at the collegiate level. Cronin's been around forever. You know, he's a staple. Great coach, obviously. His style has been that slow it down, defensive-minded, but, you know, efficient offensively, but slow it down, play through the post. This year, they're way more set on, better suited to run and at least push the tempo a little bit and then get into the half-court offense. I know it's been talked about. I know Cronin has talked about it. You're around the program. You know the program. Do you, A, trust it happening, and do you sense that Cronin is truly fine with it? Because coaches hate change. It doesn't matter what level they're at. Coaches hate changing.
Well, let's hit on a couple things here, and I know these things that I talk about aren't popular at all times, but when you look at Mick Cronin, when you look at his coaching history, his second year at Murray State,
that was
they averaged over 80 points a game. Why? Because he had the talent to play fast.
That's the only time he's been top 100 or top – it's even more than that. The only time he's been only top, I want to say, like 200 in tempo.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of that is defense when you do overall tempo because takes so long to score on a Cincinnati team. But let's not pretend like their offense has moved at a rapid pace. What happened, I think, when he got to the Big East, he had to scrap together everything he could. He had to go get guys like Rashad Bishop, and he had to figure out a way to stay in games and actually have a chance to win them in that old Big East.
Right.
What you're seeing now is the philosophy at Cincinnati changed 4 or 5 years ago. But it's not like Kentucky, where when the philosophy changes 4 years ago, the roster changes 4 years ago.
Right.
So when he started adding Gary Clark and Jacob Evans and then Jaron Cumberland and now Kane Broome and Keith Williams, that takes some time for that roster to completely flip. I think what kept it from flipping maybe a little bit earlier than he wanted, I think he realized when he got to the American, I don't have to hold teams to 52 points to win in this conference.
Yeah, we're better already than everyone else,
right,
essentially.
But – And this is – I've taken blowback for this for 7 years, probably longer. You know what you need in order to play fast? A point guard that's fast.
Yeah, Calpain fit the half court, slow it down. Let me dictate this from 30 feet instead of 90 feet.
And when Troy was recruited, when Troy committed to Cincinnati, the Big East hadn't blown up yet.
Right.
He was going to be like one of the things in his commitment story that I wrote was that his dream was to play in Madison Square Garden at the Big East tournament. So that was one of the.
Did he commit in 11, right? If he was class of 12. So he committed.
He was 11. A freshman. He was a freshman SK's senior year.
Okay.
So it was right before everything happened. But he was supposed to be in that league. Now, you're not going to push Troy Copain aside because he was a really good player. He was very steady. He made plays at the end of games. He was a solid defender. He didn't turn the ball over. He was a very good fit for a lot of the philosophies that Cronin had. The one thing he wasn't a fit for was playing faster.
Right, right.
So that just had to work itself out as Mick was reshaping the rest of the roster. Mick went out and got Justin Jennifer. With the idea that Justin Jennifer played at a faster tempo. And then the next year he added Kane Broome as a transfer to sit out Troy's senior year. So now you've got that ability to play faster. Troy Copain can't play fast. Like no matter how much you scream at him and you tell him you want to play fast and you want to play up tempo, he doesn't have the speed to get the ball and beat the defense end to end 10 times a game. It's not happening.
Well, I think not only that, it's the wings that they have now, too.
When you
look at the Evans and Cumberland, it's you don't have to worry about – I mean, Broome can do it, but you don't have to worry about him putting the ball on the deck and trying to get it. You can quickly get a defensive rebound, outlet it up, you know, past the three-point line, another you know, diagonal pass, and then you're out and running.
And then one of those two guys is at the rim in three steps.
Yep, exactly.
So, it's a matter of Mick – decided that he could change his philosophy when he got into this conference. It has just taken some time to build the roster in that light. You know, you look at the point guard that they landed in this 2018 recruiting class, Logan Johnson. He's another guy that can do that. Not a huge name. He kind of blew up in the summer. But his brothers turned out to be pretty good after signing a four-year, $50 million contract in Miami, Tyler Johnson.
He's not bad.
He was a walk-on.
Yeah.
Started his career as a walk-on. So they're continuing with this philosophy of being more offensive-minded and being able to push tempo and being able to score more points. I think Mick has wanted to do that for a couple years now, but it just takes time to get everything in place. When you're at this level, you can't go out, get one recruiting class of four top 100 kids, and all of a sudden you're a different team.
Right.
That's just not how it works in the American Athletic Conference.
Do you?
I even think like it doesn't work like that for even just a lot of schools throughout the country. Like if you try and toss a bunch of guys that aren't made to do one thing, do it, it ends up backfiring. And then you're dealing with bringing in recruits that can do it versus guys that really can't do it. And you just get a hodgepodge of a mixture. Yeah. And then the coach ends up looking like he doesn't know what he's doing. So I guess it's smart by Cronin to make sure he has the pieces because he's basically done okay, you know, with the talent that he's had. He just had to, you know, play and coach the way that he knows his team is going to be most successful based off his roster.
Yeah, and that's really what he's done the entire time. And that's why I used that Murray State example because when he had that roster, it was a veteran team. They had guys that could really play fast. That was the best style. It wasn't like he went into that and said, no, we're slowing it down with this team. He said, this is what's best for us to win. That's how we're going to play. Now that he has that at Cincinnati, that's how they're going
to
play.
There has to be a level of trust with him and his you know, veteran leadership. And usually in the guard position, that's where it counts.
Absolutely. That's where Kane Broome is having a little bit of a rough October learning how to be Mick Cronin's point guard.
Right. And that's my question mark for them coming in is, yeah, he put up gaudy numbers at Sacred Heart, but now you're talking about a completely different system and having to adjust to not doing that.
Well, yeah, the thing was that the gaudiest number he put up at Sacred Heart maybe wasn't the 23.5 points.
It was his ridiculous turnover percentage.
It was his 4.5 turnovers a game. I joked with him. He's gotten – as October has gone on, he's getting the hang of it. And you know, Mick isn't going to pull you out of the game if you're driving down the lane in transition. Somebody tips the ball, it kicks off your foot and goes out of bounds.
Right.
He's not pulling you out of the game for that. But if you come off a ball screen and throw a lazy one-handed pass across the court that gets picked off and taken for a dunk, guess what you're doing?
That's when you
drinking water.
You're drinking water at the bench. So that's what he's trying to get out of him. And kind of a funny story, I was talking to Kane about it like 4 or 5 days into practice. And I said, you know, yeah, he's going to be tough on you, but Mick's allergic to turnovers. Like one of his coaching philosophies is do not turn the ball over and especially live ball turnovers. So he's allergic to turnovers. And Kane looks at me and he goes, yeah, the problem is right now I'm addicted to him.
At least,
although I feel like Cronin could be the Herman Boone type who would tell him water makes you weak.
There's not a lot of water breaks at a Cincinnati practice.
But I think with tempo, though, part of it, too, goes, like you mentioned, it's slow. When you look at the adjusted tempo, it's slow because of how they drain you defensively. Getting this athletic team that Cincinnati has, defensively, you can get a little more versatile with it, where you can extend the defense a little bit more. You can run a little bit more traps. You can run a little bit more switching man-to-man. Do you see that changing at all, or is it still just
– Absolutely.
Yeah, that's my question. Because when you think Cronin, you think Cincinnati, you think defense – but you see it across the country at the even higher level of, hey, this team's more made to run a three-quarter court trap press. Does Cronin adjust that? Has he talked? I haven't heard anything. I don't know. I'm sure you have. Has he talked about adjusting his defense at all?
I think there's going to be a lot more pressure. Okay. They didn't do it a lot last year because they just didn't. Again, you know, you got to have the speed and the athleticism to do that, and it wasn't a good fit necessarily for the roster that they had in place.
Right.
I think it's much, much better of a fit now, especially not just the starters, but there's a ton of athleticism on the bench. When you look from Keith Williams to Trey Scott to Nizir Brooks, to Mamadou Diarra, they're a lot more athletic on the bench, where you can cycle and you can put a couple guys in if you want to turn up the pressure and
bust your ass for 5 minutes and then come sit out.
And then come sit out. Yeah. I mean, that definitely. Now, what I'm interested to see this year, one of the staples over the Copain era was the matchup zone.
Yeah.
And I'm interested to see how much of that matchup zone we see versus how much we see of, you know, more of a switching man to man, more of a straight up man to man. You know, how
throw a little more traps out there.
Yeah. How does he adjust his half court defense? Because they've been really good in that matchup zone. The one part that has killed them in that matchup zone is overloading the box and then getting that wide open corner three.
Right.
If you look at their defensive numbers, yeah, they've been top 15 in the country, but they've been way down the list. Teams are shooting 34-35% from three against, you know, what should be an incredible defense. When you look at the rest of the numbers, where they've been incredible is 2-point defense, and they still, you're not scoring around the rim against Cincinnati, but maybe they switch things up a little bit this year and you see, you know, teams shooting 31-32% from three because they're not sitting in that matchup zone the entire time and allowing teams to overload and then get that wide open baseline 3-point shot.
So, you know, around the city, you hear it, obviously me and you both being in Cincinnati, there's high expectations about the team. You know, I think this is by far the most talented team that Cronin's had. At least that I can remember when you look at depth and everything with it, players that can just go play.
Yeah.
What do you think is the kind of baseline to make this season a success versus a failure? And I don't want to say their ceiling's a Final Four team or anything like that, because you never know matchups, like you said. You
no.
Know.
But I think
what's a success for this season?
Well, the Final Four thing gets brought up some. What I would say about that is, this is like for the first time in the Cronin era, this isn't a team that if they made the Final Four, I would be like, oh my God,
how the hell did that happen?
Yeah, boy, they had everything fall their way. I think this is a team that can win their way into the Final Four. That doesn't mean I think they're a Final Four team. This team has to be a Sweet 16 team.
That's kind of my consensus. Someone asked me that the other day. The question was, is Cincinnati good enough to win this title, win a title? It's like, no. Maybe they are, just because to win six games in a row is tough, and you never know what could happen. Like, you could play, you could be Syracuse and play a 10 seed, a 5th, or a 7 seed, a 15 seed, and a 11 seed on your way to the Elite Eight. But
go back to UC's last Final Four.
What was that, 90?
92. When their bracket blew up, and they went.
And that could happen. I mean, you never know.
Yeah.
But, you know, my feeling is the same thing. This is a second weekend team. And that's the way I describe it. Is, you know, I think for this team to be a success, and call me if I'm wrong, but it's, you have to finish top two in the regular season in the conference.
Yes.
You have to win, I'd say, two, you know, you have to either – who are the big non-conference games? Florida, Xavier, who's the other one? Iowa, let's say, if they meet out there in –
At UCLA, UCLA, and Mississippi State at home.
So where is the UC, the Cincinnati Xavier game?
That's at
Xavier.
At X.
I think you need to win three of those games.
Well,
that's going to be a fun game.
Here's the really tough part about this. Because of the arena renovation.
Yep, you lose that.
Well, I think they're going to have a very good home court advantage at BB&T Arena.
It's still just not the same.
We'll see.
Yeah,
I know. I've been in that place with like 4,000 people for a big NKU game, and it gets loud in there. The way that arena is built, it presents itself to a very nice home court advantage.
Sure.
But because of the way things are, they've got a 2-week stretch. And Ben, I'd love to get your take on this. A 2-week stretch starting December 2nd, going through December 16th. They go at Xavier, Florida neutral, Mississippi State at home, UCLA on the road.
That's very bearable, mostly because obviously, you know, Xavier, you're not really going anywhere. Where's the neutral site game?
Florida is in New York City, Prudential Center.
Ooh, see, I don't know. I think that's like a schedule where you look at it and you really embrace the opportunity because – you know, Florida's got to travel from Gainesville all the way up to New York. Again, Xavier, it's obviously in your city. At UCLA, UCLA is not as good as they were last year, so it's definitely a game that's winnable. I would embrace that personally because you got a good mix of home games versus a rivalry game plus a neutral site game. And if this team's what it's made out to be, they should go at least 3-1, and that would be, I don't know, 2-2 would be not a failure, but it wouldn't be the expectations that the team should have for this.
If they go 3-1 in that stretch, that boosts them probably 2 seed lines, right, Bobby?
I was going to ask you guys, what do you guys think they'll end up being in the tournament?
I think a 4 seed is a realistic possibility.
I see them as a 4 seed too, 3 being like the max. But if they're a 4 seed, it's just that's where it becomes tough for them and being in this conference to make that jump of, yeah, could this team get to the Final Four by beating a 1 seed? Of course they can. But being a 3 seed versus a 4 seed, I think is the biggest difference when you're in an NCAA tournament.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a 4, you play a 5 in the second round, and that's a coin flip.
Right.
And it's usually a power conference team that finished like 3rd in like the Big Ten or something like that.
Yeah, it does bump them up a seed line when you Chad. What was your question going to be? Regarding the seed line or something like that, you're getting ready to ask.
Oh, I was
like, what does it jump them to?
Yeah, if they go 3-1 and that bumps them a seed line or two, I would think. Because
I think you talk about them as a 3 seed now. I think 2 seed is out of the realm of possibility just because
I don't think the league's going to get them a 2
seed.
That's
exactly what I was about to say. As we talked before, there's just too many bad games in there. Where you have the ACC and like the Big East and even this year like the SEC that's gotten all better where they're just better quality wins, opportunities for those teams that gives them the advantage over Cincinnati or Wichita, I think it's got to be a 3 seed feels max. If they go 3-1, let's say they go 4-1, you get to win over Iowa on the neutral court too. I think you're talking the 3 seed.
Yeah, and if you get a 3 seed, this is a team that could make a deep run, that could get to an Elite Eight and be in a position to play one game for a Final Four. I mean, I worry about the point guard in terms of how long does it take Kane to adjust, because if it takes him longer than a couple games, then you're into that. You're at the Cayman Islands, and then
you
right after the
loss to UAB or something like that there.
And then, if you get through the Cayman Islands, then right after you get back from the Cayman Islands is that stretch.
Yeah. God forbid you go 1-3 there.
If you go 1-3 there, you're
a 7.
You're a 5 like max.
Yeah, you're more than likely a 6-7.
Right.
Because we've seen what the committee thinks of this conference.
Absolutely.
And it's hard. Like, yes, you can say a couple teams have gotten a little bit better, but it's still hard still hard for me to trust the middle of this conference. Like, I have zero faith in it.
I agree completely. Can they win games in the out of conference? Until I see that, I'm not going to believe it.
Yeah, and it might change. Hey, maybe maybe Temple gets hot in the non-conference. Maybe they upset like a Villanova or something like that. Maybe, I'm trying to think who else. Maybe UCF gets a couple wins.
See, I like UCF.
So do I, but again, they still have to win those out of conference games.
Yeah, absolutely. Here, let me check it real quick. I've got it pulled up here in just a second. Wichita State they're fine. I'm not really worried about them. UCF has the Advocare Invitational, which has they play Nebraska first. If they win that, they'd probably play West Virginia. Eek. That would be an interesting contrast.
I'll tell you what. Here's one. Temple has. In a stretch from December 6th to December 13th, they're all home, Wisconsin, St. Joe's, Villanova.
Yeah.
And they're at Georgia to end the month. And they have South Carolina on a neutral court. Like, you have to win a couple of those games.
Yeah. UCF's got Missouri at home to end November. That could be a pretty big scalp if Missouri is – what they look like against Kansas
and Alabama and at Alabama
and at Alabama. Later. Yeah. UConn Arizona and Auburn, yeah. They're in that exempt PK 80 event.
So who knows? That could turn out to be all over the place there.
Yeah. Oregon and Michigan State are DePaul in the first two games. If you lose that and you get DePaul, it's a waste, right?
Right, right.
It's a complete waste. Houston, and then you'd probably play Portland or somebody in the last game.
Yeah, and that's just pointless. Houston has Arkansas and Providence. You need to win one of those two games. Like you said, if that doesn't happen, then you're looking at Wichita and Cincinnati and possibly SMU paying the price come March.
Yeah. I mean, there's some games in there. And actually, the more I look at it, there's more of them at home than there has been in the past.
Yeah, there's a lot of chances. There's a lot of reasonable chances.
I
think Temple will beat Villanova, no, but there's a lot more reasonable chances.
Right, but Houston gets Arkansas at home and Providence on the road.
You should split that.
Yeah. That stretch for Temple, Wisconsin and Villanova at home is two huge opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, you got to beat Wisconsin, I think, at home. Even at Georgia, I don't think Georgia's going to be that good this year.
No, and they've pulled off the Villanova miracle a couple times.
They have.
Where it's like, how the hell, you know? I mean, there's a reason that the AAC Coach of the Year Award is the Fran Dunphy Memorial Trophy.
I loved when I'd spend a summer working at Temple with Fran.
He wins that like every other year. He has a big year, and then they have a down year, and then the next year he brings them back, and they just give him the Coach of the Year Trophy.
Oh, yeah. All the time.
It's the Fran Dunphy Memorial AAC Coach of the Year Trophy. Hopefully they're better. I mean, the thing I questioned with them, I didn't think they had much toughness last year at all.
Which is that's not a Fran Dunphy.
No.
Team. And Fran Dunphy teams, they'll punch in your they'll kick your ass.
I like Shiz Alston a lot. One of the great nicknames in college basketball.
Oh yeah.
So I UC had dabbled with Alston a little bit on the recruiting trail, and I go up to his coach, and LeVan is his first name, I think.
Okay.
So I'm like, hey, can I talk to LeVan, please? The coach is like, yeah, one second. He turns around and he screams at the top of his lungs, Shiz! Did you just call him Shiz? Like,
yeah, that's what he goes by.
I'm like, coach, you got to sign this kid. His right, nickname is Shiz.
Right.
I want to use Shiz Alston for 4 years. Please, let's get this done.
Go ahead.
I'm not a big Quentin Rose guy for Temple, but I think Josh Brown tempers that some because Rose is better off the ball. What I don't like him as is a point guard because he shoots too much. He's not – I don't think he does well at the point guard spot. I think that was some of their problem. So you bring Brown back, you move him off the ball. You got Alston.
Guys coming off the bench.
Yeah, you've got Aflac or Aflac P or whatever his name is at center.
Yeah.
That's kind of a toughness, rebounding, physical guy for them.
They got good size. Guys over 6'10".
I'm not a big Obi guy, though.
I think he's fine. Like, I think
– okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard. He's one of those guys that is either going to be underrated or overrated. Like, it's hard for people just to say he's an average player. Like,
yeah,
he's not underrated. He's not overrated. He's just there. Like,
he's just
fine. He's fine. Yeah. Like, he's fine. Like, you can win at Temple with him as your, but he, I don't want him.
You
to
can't
be your
win.
Guy.
Yeah, he can't be your number two guy. If he's your fourth guy, you're in good shape.
Even if he's your third, like I think you're fine if he's your third.
I'll give you that, but I'd rather him be my fourth.
Oh, for sure. But I think he's still fine. Like in this conference, you're fine with him as your third.
Yeah, he's 6'10". He can stretch the floor. I mean, he can hit some shots, or 6'8", whatever he is. Yeah. He can hit some shots. He's got a decent skill level, but I think he's a guy that lacks that toughness that kind of defined them last year. So,
right.
Another game for them, neutral South Carolina. They can win that game.
Yeah, I think South Carolina's not good.
No, not this year.
All right, last question before we let you get out of here. Cincinnati or Wichita State and why? Assuming all healthy.
It's so razor thin, I think. I know you've got Wichita State a little bit higher than I do. I think the line of demarcation between these two teams is razor thin. I think some of that, I know it's very – tempting to look at what they did in the Missouri Valley and to just automatically translate that over into the American. I think the American is going to be improved in the middle of this year. I'm not saying it's going to be good. I'm saying it's going to be substantially better than the middle of the Missouri Valley. So I think they I think they see a lot more bumps in the road than they're used to, and I'm curious as to how they handle that in year one. I think as you get further into it, it becomes much simpler to project because then they adjust and they realize, you know, when we go into SMU, into that little bandbox, it's going to be a really tough night. When we go into UCF and you've got a seven foot six guy standing at the rim, that's going to be a little bit tougher. But I think Cincinnati actually – what I wouldn't be surprised is if it ends in a tie.
I mean, it's going to. It's going. They're both going to win at home.
Yeah. I mean, I think they both win at home.
And then someone loses in the conference semis.
They both drop a game on the road. And they both end up 16-2.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I mean, for me, it's just I'm such a Shamit stan that
– I know you are.
I just think he's the best player in the league, which I give – I'll just take that. And I agree, though. I think it is closer than.
I mean, the coaches pick Cincinnati, right?
Yeah.
So yeah. I think most people in the know think it's as close as we think it is.
Right, and that's fair. That's fair.
I think it's razor thin because I really like both teams.
Yeah, they're both good. They're both I have them both.
I think it's fair. Yeah, I think Chad brings up a really, really good point about Wichita State, though. I mean, in the middle of their, you know, conference schedule, they're going over to Indiana State, Missouri State, and they're blowing teams out on the road. I mean, the AAC isn't, you know, it's not a Power Six. We've made that clear. But it's better, in my opinion, than the Missouri Valley, where, like you said, if you go into SMU, if you go into some of these places, it's going to be a little bit different of an atmosphere. And it's just not going to be a cakewalk where you're favored by 22. Like these are going to be different type games, and it's going to be more of a grind. And how they respond to that is yet to be seen. But they'll adjust as time goes. But the injuries early on don't help.
No, absolutely not.
They're foot injuries. I worry. Like you got to worry about recurring issues with foot injuries.
Well, this is recurring for Shamit, which is scary.
Right, and McDuffie now has to deal with it too. So. If you look at their rosters, if you look at the top five for each, I think they're both very close. I think there's some positions where you give Wichita State a slight edge. There's some positions where you give Cincinnati a slight edge. I like both benches. Both coaches are really good. Like it's so razor thin. Gun to my head, I think Cincinnati just gets that slight advantage because they've experienced this conference for a couple years, and it's the first time Wichita's doing it. And like Ben mentioned, you know, you don't get that off night in, you know, late January where you go into a team that stinks and you beat them by 35 and you're up by 20, you know, 6 minutes into the game and everybody's on coast.
It's a different grind in this AAC versus the Missouri Valley.
What you mentioned real quick. Do you go backcourt advantage, Wichita, front court, Cincinnati?
I go point guard advantage, Wichita.
Yeah.
I go wings even, if not.
Yeah, because it's what, Fran Camp and who's the other wing for Wichita?
His name is escaping me right now.
But I know who you're talking about.
And then front court's an advantage to Cincinnati.
Yeah.
So can get, man. I mean, these two teams are both really good.
They are, which is a shame that the rest of the conference isn't.
I have hope for the middle this year. I have some hope for the middle.
I do, but again, it's one of those, like, I still show need me. To see them do this.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
There's no reason for them not – the way to phrase it is there's no reason for not to have hope, but I'm very, very, very skeptical.
I'm with you 100%. So I'm right there with you. I think 3-7 should be better. I don't have any hope for the bottom.
Right.
South Florida is going to be awful. I think Memphis is going to be awful. SMU and Tulsa or Tulane, no good.
Yeah.
So I have hope for the middle, though. But We just went over the games. You've got to win some of those games in the out of conference to show people we're not terrible.
I agree. But all right, man, thanks for coming on.
No problem. Surprising. That went long. Shocking.
Yeah, I know. Shocking. everyone can follow Chad on Twitter at Chad Brendel, B-R-E-N-D-E-L, BearcatJournal.com. And Chad, where can they find the podcast and everything?
You can find us on SoundCloud, BCJ Podcast. We had a good one tonight, Leonard Stokes.
Same Twitter handle too, right? BCJ yep. Podcast.
BCJ Podcast. We had Leonard Stokes tonight. We're going football tomorrow night. A name. I don't know if you, how big of a football guy are you?
I saw you tweet it out, and I was like, I know that name. And then when I Googled it, I was like, oh, yeah, that's who that is.
Haruki Nakamura,
yep.
Who was here when Mark D'Antonio got the job and then was a star in the early Brian Kelly years. And then shockingly, it was funny. He came back for a game like 3 weeks ago. And I had one of the guys that works for me now that wasn't familiar with that era. He's like, who is that? I'm like, that's Haruki Nakamura. He's a Bearcat great. He's like, he's tiny.
Oh,
yeah. I'm like, hey, yeah, he played 4 years and 5 years in the NFL and he was phenomenal. And he was a special teams ace. And he's like, 400th degree black belt, and he will whip your ass if he hears you say something bad about him.
Yeah, I remember him just because we're the same age.
Yeah.
So, like, I remember watching Cincinnati games, you know, when D'Antonio was here and Kelly was here. So,
yeah.
Good stuff. Make sure you follow Chad at Chad Brendel. And thanks a lot, man, again for coming on.
No problem. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you, man.
All right, so that was our interview with Chad. I thought that was another awesome interview. Hope everybody enjoyed it. That was a good detailed look at the conference and Cincinnati, which is, again, one of those kind of intriguing teams because there are expectations there, and there's expectations for the conference as a whole. And you know, Chad's very well connected to the program and knows the conference and everything like that. So we talked about it at length. I agree that, you know, the middle of this conference needs to do something.
When you look at a team like Cincinnati, even Wichita State, like, the good news about those type teams is if, you know, you could say every team controls their own destiny, but in this case, I think they control it a little more because of the teams that they're going to play. Not that they're bad, but like, because you're not in a conference where, you know, when you're picked to be favored and pretty much compete with just one other team, if you take care of your business, then you have a chance to put yourself in a position to get a decent seed. And then if you make a run, you make a run because you have the talent to do it.
So we'll end on this. We talked about it before the interview that we wanted to just talk real quick about Midnight Madness because they all went on over the last couple weeks. They're all wrapped up. You said something that I did not know, and that is that you never participated in Midnight Madness.
Never participated. We do a red-white scrimmage, free to the public, and it's very Wisconsin.
You guys are the most cliche.
Yep.
And like, you're not even like nerds because like Duke is nerd, but you guys are like cliche.
I wanted to talk about the Duke one. That was weird. Loved
it. Embraced the shit out of being a nerd.
Oh, completely agree. I just thought it was like really awkward and weird.
Was the best part was the body languages?
Well, I was going to say like of the players on Duke, like Grayson Allen doing that, cool, but like – Marvin Bagley
looked like he wanted to be in Southern California.
That's what I was saying. Like that whole like dynamic of the mixture of players that they have with the music, with the nerds, with it just being Duke. It was. I wish I could have been there just to be a nerd with them.
Right, and like Trayvon Duval looked like he was dancing, just being like, I only have to be here for 1 year.
Yeah, act like you're like cool with the white guys right. And everything.
that was something. But do you wish you ever – guys, like, do you wish you did a Midnight Madness?
Of course. Yeah, I would have made a fool of myself. Like, I would have, like, been all hyped up and, like, tried to do a cool dunk and, like, missed it. I would be like, oh, classic.
Because it's all just a production. Like, it's not
– yeah, it's all for the fans. Like,
yeah. There's nothing – I don't know. It's just a production.
I wish we would have done, like – I don't know. Like, it would have been cool to even do, like, a three-point contest. Like, just do some, like, gimmicky type stuff as Oakley is licking the mic.
Yeah, my dog just ran down. I'm like – completely jumped into the middle of everything. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, like I wrote a blog about Grand Canyon's Midnight Madness and the production that goes into it. And they plan it out for over a year and, you know, sells out. It's crazy. It's crazy, but not crazy to me that Wisconsin doesn't do it.
That's not crazy at all. It's not even shocking.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's not crazy just because it's Wisconsin, but it's also crazy because Wisconsin's like, you know, a top five program.
How you think of them is what exactly we are going to get from practice, from shoot around, from Midnight Madness to the coaching style to everything. Everything that you think it is.
I just assume like your pregame meals were like cheese and potatoes.
Our training table was very bland.
So,
we weren't eating tacos before the game. I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
much.
No, not at all. So that wraps up episode 31. Episode 32 is Friday, and it is a very, very important episode because it is live from Queen City Exchange. Ben's going to be on Skype. I'm going to be in attendance with Rick Browering.
Is my face going to be up like on a screen?
That's the plan, but we'll see how it goes.
Lucky them.
Rick Browering, who covers Xavier, will be in attendance with me as we do our Big East preview with him. Obviously, if you're in the Cincinnati area, come attend. There will be drink specials. There's Pop a Shot. It's going to be just an awesome experience as we get ready for our December 9th one. So, again, 6:30 on Friday at Queen City Exchange. If you're coming, shoot me a message. Shoot the show a message so I know, like, afterwards – how long I'm going to plan drinking for and talking more basketball with. So looking forward to that. I think it's going to be really cool. We're probably going to go to two episodes a week here starting soon just because we're running out of time before the season with previews and then the season starts. So be on the lookout for that. Episodes will probably start getting a little bit shorter once we get out of preview season and just start doing more game stuff and season stuff. But, again, make sure you subscribe to the show. Rate, review, everything like that. We prefer 5 stars. You know, that helps. So let's do that. Follow us on Instagram, FundamentalESD. Follow us on Twitter, FundamentalESD. Ben, any last words?
Nothing. Just inching away. And I'm ready for college basketball. Obviously, I've enjoyed watching the NBA just because it's, you know, something to watch that's basketball. But I'm excited, like, especially after, like, previewing, like, we've made predictions. We've talked about pretty much every team almost so far in depth, and we're going to get to two more major conferences. And then it's just put your money where your mouth is and see if your predictions are right or if you look like a complete fool. And it's usually a mixture of both.
For sure. For sure. So, again, we'll see everybody on Friday and hopefully in person.